The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information that comes largely from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And you may recall that on a previous episode, we started talking about transplantation. And I'd like to continue this subject by talking about liver transplant. This comes from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of May 2020. When your liver is damaged, whether by hepatitis B or C viral infections, excessive toxins, including alcohol or medications, or another cause, it can form scar tissue. Over time, this scarring, known as cirrhosis, can impair your liver's ability to function and eventually lead to liver failure. A liver can also quickly shut down in a matter of weeks, a process known as acute liver failure. This is most often the result of an overdose of a medication, particularly acetaminophen, which is found in Tylenol and other medications. Doctors sometimes treat liver failure with a liver transplant. A liver transplant may also be used to treat liver cancer. Your liver performs several critical functions for your body, including processing nutrients and removing toxins from the blood. Once the liver fails, it's often a challenge for doctors to keep you alive until your liver can heal itself or until you're able to receive a liver transplant. Transplants are usually performed with livers from deceased donors. Deceased donor livers of older adults into their 80s can be used safely for some transplants. Donating a portion of your liver while alive also is possible. This is because, unlike other organs, livers can regrow or regenerate. However, this is much less likely to be an option for older adults. Compared with rates for deceased donor liver transplants, complication rates with living donor liver transplants are higher. And these complications are generally tougher for older adults to weather than they are for younger people. During transplant surgery, after general anesthesia is administered, the diseased liver is removed. The donor liver is then placed in your body, and blood vessels and bile ducts are attached in place. However, sometimes a bile duct is missing, damaged, or too small to connect to the donated liver. In this case, the surgeon attaches the donor bile duct to your small intestine instead. Adults 65 and older made up about 22% of liver transplant recipients in 2019. Mayo Clinic experts say that very fit and otherwise healthy adults older than 65 can do well after liver transplants. Mayo Clinic is working to develop a bioartificial liver, known as the spheroid reservoir bioartificial liver, SRBAL, that would function outside of a person's body, using a pig or human liver cells to filter blood. The hope is that this device could support an injured liver as it heals to avoid a liver transplant or help those with end-stage liver disease who are awaiting transplant. The article goes on to talk about other kinds of advances in transplant. In addition to the exciting research areas that were already talked about, including genetically engineering pig hearts, ex vivo lung perfusion, and bioartificial livers, scientists are also exploring a process called bioprinting. Researchers are experimenting with 3D bioprinting technology to create artificial tissues and organs. This is done by using bioinks, which can contain cells and biomaterials like collagen that are printed in layers. Not only could this technology help alleviate the perpetual shortage of donated organs, it could also help prevent rejection, because organs could be made from the recipient's own cells. One major challenge has been the difficulty of creating a system of small blood vessels needed to bring nutrients to the organ. However, advances continue to be made, and scientists have already bioprinted items like heart valves. Then there's a process called recellularization. This process takes a donor organ, strips it of all the cells, then repopulates the organs with new cells. Since the cells may be acquired from the recipient's own tissues, this could potentially sidestep the problem of rejection. In addition, this method could potentially use organs that would otherwise be rejected for transplantation, thus increasing the supply of donor organs. Unlike bioprinting, decellularized organs can provide a natural scaffold for the cells and may be able to maintain the original blood vessel system. Why not donate? Every day, an average of about 20 people die waiting for a donor organ. Some people choose not to be potential organ donors due to the following myths. Some people think they're just too old. There isn't an age cutoff for organ donation. One U.S. donor was 92 years old. They might think they're too sick to donate. Your organ is evaluated after you die to see if it can be transplanted. Certain organs may not be suitable, but other organs and tissues may be fine. Some people worry that the doctors aren't going to try to save their life if they know they're an organ donor. If you're in a life-threatening situation, saving your life is the only priority of doctors treating you. Some people worry that the cost will burden their family. Your family isn't financially responsible for any aspect of organ donation. Some people worry that they might not be able to have an open casket funeral. Organ and tissue donation doesn't interfere with having an open casket funeral. The donor's body is treated with care and respect. Some people think that the organs just go to wealthy or famous people, but organ allocation isn't based on wealth or celebrity status. If you wish to be a donor, register yourself in your state or national organ donation registry and include donor designation on your driver's license. It's important to inform your family of your wishes, as hospitals may seek consent from your next of kin before removing organs. You may also include your wishes in a living will or in a health care advance directive. Now, what happens after a transplant? Well, a major risk after a successful transplant surgery is organ rejection. This is when the immune system sees the organ as something foreign and tries to destroy it. When this happens quickly, it's known as acute rejection and most commonly happens within a few weeks of a transplant. If you experience acute organ rejection, you may have to take high doses of immunosuppressive drugs, steroids, or both to bring it under control. You may have to go back to the hospital, and in rare cases, the organ may fail. Chronic organ rejection is more insidious and develops over time, sometimes in transplant recipients who have had multiple episodes of acute rejection. Chronic rejection is not well understood, but there isn't much you can do about it. It's untreatable. There are many things to keep in mind after a transplant, and there are some of these things are your responsibility. For example, you need to take immunosuppressive medications that are prescribed. These drugs guard against rejection by curbing your body's immune system. They can cause many side effects, including increased risk of infection, but you still ought to take your medicine just the way it's instructed. Never miss an appointment. After a transplant, you'll need to have blood tests, and in some cases, biopsies done on a regular basis. These tests are crucial because they can detect signs of organ rejection before you feel any symptoms. Watch for cancer. Immunosuppression medications can lower your immune system's ability to prevent some cancers, so it's important to protect yourself. When you go out in the sun, wear sun protective clothing, or stay in the shade and use generous amounts of sunscreen. Your skin ought to be checked periodically for skin cancer as well. While doctors generally agree certain women can consider stopping routine Pap testing at age 65, solid organ transplant recipients need to continue to be screened. Screening for anal cancer may also be recommended. You should also undergo any other regular cancer screenings that your physician recommends. You also need to keep your bones strong because certain immunosuppressive drugs can cause bone loss. Make sure you're getting adequate calcium and vitamin D in your diet, or with supplementation as recommended by your doctor. Stay as active as possible with weight-bearing exercises such as walking. Talk to a member of your transplant team about an activity program that is right for you. You also need to maintain a healthy mind because immunosuppression medication, the stress of surgery, and a lengthy rehabilitation can sometimes trigger mood changes that make it difficult to fully participate in rehab and stay focused on your medical care. Pay attention to feelings of depression or anxiety and let the transplant team know so that medication or counseling can be used to help manage these symptoms. Exercise, being a problem solver, using your support network, maintaining optimism, and using your sense of humor are all healthy ways of coping after a transplant. It's also important that you need to know the signs of rejection. If you experience any of the signs or symptoms of rejection, which vary by organ but may include fever, tiredness, or swelling, you need to let a health professional know about it right away. Now we're going to turn to the subject of cataracts, and this is from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of April 2020. Get your sight right. It can feel like an unhappy rite of aging. Your vision gets blurry and worsens as time goes on. You visit the doctor and together decide it's time to have cataract surgery. Fortunately, most people are able to have this common problem treated successfully with surgery. In fact, cataract removal is the most common type of surgery done for Americans age 65 and older. In general, if your vision seems reasonably good, there's no harm in putting off cataract surgery. But glare, blur, and the need for more light can become bothersome and start to interfere with your daily activities. There are numerous benefits to having the procedure done when vision becomes impaired, including reducing the risk of falls and improving your ability to drive a car, pursue active hobbies, and live independently. The eye's lens is located just behind the iris, the colored part of your eye. Light that enters the eye is focused by the lens, producing an image on the retina at the back of your eye. The retina sends this information to the vision center in the brain, allowing you to see. The lens is where a cataract developed. A normal lens is crystal clear. As a cataract forms, the precisely arranged protein fibers of your lens begin to break down, clump together, and lose their transparency. This lens cloudiness scatters light and prevents a sharp, focused image from reaching your retina. Cataracts are described based on the part of the lens that's cloudy and the severity of the cloudiness. Small areas of one or both lenses begin to cloud at first, and early on you may not be aware of any vision changes. However, the clouding gradually spreads and becomes more dense, impacting vision to an increasingly greater degree. Vision changes may include increasingly blurred or dim vision, increasing difficulty with your vision at nighttime, sensitivity to bright light and glare, perception of halos around lights, and double vision in one eye. With a routine eye exam, an eye doctor can identify lens clouding and determine how dense it is and how much it affects your vision. An eye exam can also help identify any other eye diseases. That may be contributing to your impaired vision, such as glaucoma, macular degeneration, or eye complications related to diabetes called diabetic retinopathy. Surgery is the only treatment for cataracts. You and your eye surgeon can discuss surgical options and timing. In the early stages, you may be able to put off surgery and still go about your routine by making adjustments such as using different eyeglasses, using magnifying lenses to read, using stronger lighting, or wearing sunglasses to reduce glare. When impaired vision starts to interfere with daily tasks, surgery becomes a stronger consideration. A coexisting eye disease can impact the timing of cataract surgery. In some cases, the cataract may need to be removed even if it isn't causing major vision loss, because it's interfering with treatment, or another eye disease such as glaucoma or diabetic retinopathy. In other cases, it may be best to treat the other eye disease before proceeding with cataract removal. Another timing factor relates to using the drug Tamsulosin or Flomax or other alpha-adrenergic blocking drugs to improve urine flow in men with enlarged prostate glands. Sometimes these drugs may also be used to address bladder issues in men and women. Alpha-adrenergic blocking drugs can lead to increased risk of complications with cataract surgery. If you already take these drugs, your surgeon can make adjustments to minimize risks. However, if drug therapy for an enlarged prostate is planned, you may want to consider having cataract surgery before taking an alpha-adrenergic blocking drug. What kind of things should you expect with surgery? Well, surgery is usually an outpatient procedure lasting less than an hour. You're also likely to spend a short time in recovery after the procedure. Surgery is usually performed on one eye at a time. Before the surgery can start, your eye will be dilated. Typically, mild intravenous sedation and local anesthetics around the eye are all that are needed to keep people comfortable during surgery. Cataract surgery involves removing the clouded natural lens from the eye and replacing it with an artificial lens. In otherwise healthy eyes, cataract removal results in improved vision in a vast majority of people. Before surgery, measurements of the eye are made to determine the appropriate power of the artificial lens. Having had prior laser or refractive surgery such as LASIK and photorefractive keratectomy, PRK, to correct your vision makes the calculation of the appropriate artificial lens power more challenging, with less predictable results. One way to get around this is to make sure you have a record of your eye measurements made before you had refractive surgery. Now, what are the major surgical options? Well, one kind is phacoemulsification. This is spelled phacoemulsification. This is the most common method of cataract surgery. A very small incision is made in the clear, rounded outer surface of your eye. A thin ultrasound probe is inserted through the small cornea incision to break up the clouded natural lens. Lens pieces are then removed by suction. What's left is the clear outer rim of the lens, which is called the capsule. The artificial lens is folded, inserted into the eye, and then allowed to unfold within the capsule. The capsule supports the artificial lens in much the same way the natural lens was supported. Most often, the incision will heal without any stitches. Another procedure is called FLACS, or femtosecond laser-assisted cataract surgery. And this is a newer approach to cataract surgery involving using a laser to make the incision in the cornea and break up the clouded lens, though an ultrasound probe is still needed to complete the removal of the cataract. It hasn't been found to provide significant benefits over phacoemulsification, however, and it's not in widespread use. Then there's a technique called extracapsular cataract extraction. In uncommon circumstances where your cataract has advanced beyond the point where phacoemulsification can be done, a larger cornea incision may be made to remove the clouded lens in one piece. Complications with cataract surgery are uncommon, but can include infection, bleeding, inflammation, swelling, and retinal detachment. Complications can often be successfully treated if they occur, but in rare instances, a serious complication can result in unimproved vision or even make your vision worse. Within the next few days after surgery, any pain or discomfort should be mild, and it should diminish while your vision steadily improves. If there's any changes for the worse, like increased pain or vision changes, immediate evaluation by your eye doctor is indicated. In about 25% of those who have cataract surgery, the lens capsule that holds the lens implant in place becomes cloudy in the months or years after the surgery. This is called posterior capsule opacification. However, this complication can be treated with a simple laser procedure and make the capsule clear again. Having another eye disease in addition to cataracts may limit the extent to which the cataract surgery can improve your vision, but still a high percentage of those with other eye diseases have significant vision improvement after cataract surgery. Now we're going to go on and talk about skin cancer, which is a growing preventable problem. Skin cancer risk might seem like a concern only for young sunbathers on the beach or in tanning beds, but older adults are the most likely age group to develop and die of skin cancer. This includes melanoma, which can be especially deadly if not caught early. Skin cancer is by far the most common cancer in the United States. Rates of melanoma have more than doubled in the last two decades, from 42,000 cases in 1999 to 100,000 in 2020. A Mayo Clinic study found that in men and women age 61 and older, melanoma rates have been increasing at a much faster rate in the recent years. This isn't a reason to avoid going outdoors, but it's important to be sun smart and to take precautions against harmful ultraviolet rays. Skin cancer develops primarily on the areas of sun-exposed skin, including the scalp, the face, the lips, the ears, the neck, the chest, the legs, the arms, and the hands, but not always. There's three common types of skin cancer. These include basal cell cancer, which is by far the most common, and looks like a pearly or waxy bump or a flat, flesh-colored scar-like spot, and affects mainly sun-exposed areas. It is really highly curable if it's caught early. Another kind is squamous cell cancer. This common type of cancer may appear as a firm red nodule or as a flat spot with a scaly crusted surface. It primarily affects sun-exposed areas and usually can be easily cured. Then there's melanomas, which aren't as prevalent, fortunately, but are the most deadly of the three skin cancers. Melanoma develops in the type of cells that are called melanocytes that produce melanin, the pigment that gives your skin its color. Melanoma is often associated with abnormal or changing moles and other dark spots. It can affect sun-exposed skin, but can also occur on skin that hasn't been exposed to the sun. It's true that certain skin types are more prone to skin cancer, but even if you have darker skin or don't tend to burn, UV rays can still cause harm. So there's some important risk factors. The first is excessive UV ray exposure. Anybody who spends a considerable time in the sun can have an increased risk of skin cancer, especially if the skin isn't protected. Tanning, including exposure to tanning lamps and beds, increases the risk dramatically. The World Health Organization classifies UV tanning as putting you in the highest cancer risk category. The risk of developing subsequent melanoma increases by 75% in people who use tanning beds before age 30. Fair skin, having less pigment in your skin, means less protection from damaging UV rays. If you have blonde or red hair and light-colored eyes, you can freckle or sunburn easily. You're much more likely to develop skin cancer. A history of sunburn, particularly having had one or more blistering sunburns as a child or teenager, increases your risk of skin cancer as an adult. People who live in sunny, warm climates are exposed to more sunlight than are people who live in colder climates. Living at higher elevations, where the sunlight is strongest, also exposes you to more radiation. People who have many moles or abnormal moles are at increased risk of melanoma, particularly if the trait runs in your family. Risk also increases if your parents, siblings, or children have had skin cancer. If you've developed skin cancer once, you're at risk of developing it again. People with weakened immune systems have a greater risk of developing skin cancer. This includes people living with an organ transplant, taking immunosuppressant drugs, or living with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Whatever your risk factor, you should perform skin examinations. Check yourself from head to toe using mirrors for places you can't readily see. Pay close attention to areas that are frequently exposed to the sun, including your neck, ears, and scalp. Also examine areas that usually get less sun, like between your toes and around your genital area. Check for any new moles or discolored patches, as well as for existing moles that have changed in size, shape, or color. If any of these changes to your skin occur or start to worry you, contact your doctor. Now, the treatment options for skin cancer depend on the type. Small cancers limited to the skin surface might be removed for biopsy and not require further treatment. Additional treatment options might include the application of liquid nitrogen to freeze the cancer or the use of an electric needle to burn the cancer, laser treatment, use of a special photosensitizer drug, and application of laser light to target and destroy cancer cells, or drugs to stimulate the immune system to destroy cancer cells called immunotherapy. Surgical removal may be necessary. Specialized surgical techniques can be used to avoid removing healthy skin in sensitive areas like the face. Radiation therapy may be an option if the cancer can't be completely removed during surgery. In situations where the cancer may have spread to other areas, chemotherapy may be warranted. It goes on to say that in order to protect your skin from harmful UV rays, you should do several things, including avoid midday sun, particularly between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. You should also wear a sunscreen year-round. Sunscreens don't filter out all the harmful UV radiation, but they play a major role in overall sun protection. And you should use a broad-spectrum sunscreen with an SPF factor of at least 30, which protects you against both UVA and UVB rays. Apply the sunscreen generously and reapply every 2 hours, or more often if you're swimming or sweating. Use a generous amount of sunscreen, about the amount to fill a shot glass on all the exposed skin, including your lips, tips of your ears, and the backs of your hands and neck. You should also wear protective clothing. Sunscreens don't provide complete protection from UV rays, so wear dark, tightly woven clothing that covers your arms and legs, and wear a broad-brimmed hat. Some companies also sell photoprotective clothing. You should also avoid tanning beds. Use of tanning beds will place you at the highest possible risk of developing melanoma. You should also be aware of sun-sensitizing medications. Some common prescription and non-prescription drugs can make your skin more sensitive to sunlight, especially hydrochlorothiazide, a drug commonly used to treat high blood pressure. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Remember, our website is ncreadingservice.org.